I'm really honored to give this first talk. And well, for me, it's end of the day. So I guess that's why I'm opening here. So research I will be presenting will be overview of many works, very brief overview of many works with it that I think can be of interest, but not maybe everyone will be familiar. And then I will focus on some particular results obtained here with students at UQ. And so just to let you know, I'm based at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. And so Brisbane, for those that don't know their geography that well, is on the east coast of Australia, and Australia is on the east coast of the world. So that's where we are. And here is just a highlight of many of the collaborations that contribute to the works I'll mention. And in particular, I will focus on the works that were parts of the PhD thesis by Carolyn Wood and honors thesis of Liam Smith. And so I'll be talking about clocks as quantum systems. And the motivation for doing this and for presenting this kind of topic on this conference is that in general relativity, we know that events, well, not just events, but really every physical quantity needs to be physically, operationally defined. And so one way to think of events in general relativity is to associate them with the position and proper time of some physical system that is used or represents a clock. And in quantum theory, any system would be a quantum system. And that's the reason to consider quantum clocks in curved space-time as a topic or avenue that can give us some insights to the nature of time, not just the nature of matter, but the nature of time, and simply because we cannot really separate logically these two. So we know about time and we define time only through physical systems that can be used to measure it. And so there are many questions that people ask in the context of time and quantum theory. And some of them can be addressed or approached with the way that we are thinking of the systems. So this is just a bit of an overview of some of the questions, but this is maybe more of a placeholder. So let me just tell you what's the plan for the talk. So I'll present briefly the formalism that can describe clocks as quantum systems on curved spacetime. And then I'll tell you about some results that relate to the questions that are here highlighted. And then in particular, I will spend a little more time considering a question to which extent quantum idealized clocks can actually be considered semi-classical and when that's possible. So we like to consider there is some quantum system that measures time, and we usually think of the internal dynamics as being quantum while we consider the center of mass kind of a possibly tracking classical trajectory. And we of course know it's an idealization, and here I'd like to tell you about what are the limitations of this approach and perhaps what could be an interesting application and insight from thinking in that terms. And so to start with, we want to describe some method that can be used to measure time. And one way to think of that is in analogy to classical physics, where we consider a particle with some internal states to represent an ideal clock. And so the same exercise one can do in quantum mechanics. So one can start with some composite quantum field theory. So some in bosonic fields. And then go to one particle sector where one can then find the Hamiltonian for a single particle, single quantum particle, where the compositeness of the fields give rise to the quantized rest energy of the system. And why that can be considered to be a clock, it's very easy to see if one considers the Lagrangian transform, so the Lagrangian that corresponds to this Hamiltonian, where we see that essentially we get some rest frame Lagrangian times the proper time differential. So if you think of your textbook relativity, you will recognize P squared plus M squared is the usual dispersion relation. And the Lagrangian is indeed proportional to proper time with the mass as the proportionality factor. Now, when you have a composite particle that has some dynamics in its rest frame, instead of just a static rest mass, it has some rest energy in a rest frame. And this internal energy or rest energy is what can be used to track time. And I would like to mention the formalism that actually we also used to obtain some of the results I'll highlight later. It's convenient often for us to think in terms of redshifts of internal energy. While talking about clocks, we want to speak about proper time. And it seems by looking at Hamiltonian and Lagrangian that these two live in different formulations of dynamics. But one can also formulate this mixed picture called the Ruthian that is given by a partial Lagrange transform between Hamiltonian and Lagrangian, where you have internal energy or internal states described in terms of their Hamiltonian, so internal energies, while the center of mass is described in terms of the Lagrangian, so configuration space and the proper time. So one can have the best of both worlds. And in particular, important thing is that this, I guess, particularly visible in the in this Ruthian formulation, we see why a composite quantum particle or a composite particle in general can represent a clock. So its evolution is given in terms of proper time, and its internal states essentially measure proper time along the trajectory of the particle. While also both the internal and center of mass degrees of freedom are quantized. And so this is perhaps a way to understand or appreciate why composite quantum particles can be seen as idealized quantum clocks. And so to see how some of the key results that I would like to highlight next arise, it's instructive to go to the low energy limit of this Hamiltonian. And in particular, what I just flashed on the screen looks very much like a Newtonian dynamics. However, the main point is that with the dynamical mass, essentially what we are introducing here or bringing in from relativity is the mass energy equivalence. And this dynamical mass is only, make operationally sense as dynamics of internal degrees of freedom. So it's useful to separate out the ground state that can be then described as some mass parameter M and the dynamical part then that really then describes the driving of the internal dynamics. And if we do that, that same Newtonian like looking Hamiltonian will acquire an explicitly relativistic corrections, which I guess you will all recognize. But let me just highlight for people that maybe haven't seen that before. This first relativistic correction, so phi, okay, you will not recognize because I didn't tell you what is phi. Phi represents a gravitational potential. So this first time represents the gravitational time dilation that is included here. And the second term, the special relativistic time dilation. So if you think of momentum to lowest order here, mass will be just given by the static parameter because there is already a C squared correction. And so if you swap to configuration space, you will recover the lowest order approximation to the Lorentz factor. So V squared over C squared by 2. And so to maybe see it a little better, you can now consider that this H int, the internal Hamiltonian, drives transition with some frequency omega. And the first term, if we specialize or restrict to the homogeneous gravitational field, will give the gravitational redshift of this internal frequency, while the second term will give the Doppler shift. And so these are the kind of shifts that are well tested in experiments so far. Now, I will highlight some of the results. So what has not been tested so far is the regime where both the dynamics of the center of mass of these clocks and the internal states are quantized. So we tested the time dilation, as I flashed in the previous slide, with atomic clocks, but their position and motion in general was effectively classical. And so one can conceive a thought experiment where a single such quantum particle moves in superposition of trajectories along which different proper time elapses. So one ends up instead of a pair of twins that move on different trajectories and at the end of their voyages, they discover they have aged differently, even though they left and met at the same space-time event. In this case, one can play that same game with a single clock that ends up, say, both younger and older than itself in a superposition.
Sorry, so there are, we have two questions. I don't know if you, do you want to take them now or do you want to wait until the end?
Actually, maybe let me defer the questions until the end so that we are sure we have time to actually cover anything. I'll ask for some leniency as it's past 11 here, and so I need to properly focus to get you through. So yeah, I apologize for those impatient, and so let me keep going so that we are sure we have time for questions at the end. I hope I will have 10 minutes for questions left after the presentation, so there should be enough time to discuss. For highly complex system that the time dilation terms that I just shown you lead to an effective decoherence mechanism that can be interesting from considering the question of quantum to classical transition. Furthermore, that formalism of describing composite systems in GR, in fact, has found an interesting application also to a classical problem that we've been made aware of, namely whether equivalence between gravitational and inertial mass explicitly holds for composite systems, even in classical physics. And so there has been some debate. So of course, it was understood that it must hold because that's what GR in general tells you, but there hasn't been an explicit derivation, and all explicit derivations were showing that gravity was coupling to, not to internal energy as such, but to some combination of kinetic and internal binding energy with different prefactors. So not to total internal energy. And what we've managed to show using this this approach and our formalism in its classical incarnation was this strangely looking violation was simply an artifact of using wrong coordinates to define internal energy. Furthermore, there were some debates whether and how to even phrase equivalence principle in quantum theory. So there has been voices that because quantum systems do not move on classical trajectories, one cannot even phrase equivalence principle, because some people would perhaps prefer to phrase it in terms of independence of trajectories on the mass, while there are other voices were saying, well, there isn't any difference between what it takes to test equivalence principle for a classical or quantum system. And we've shown that actually neither of this is true, and that because essentially testing equivalence principle, and that's best visible in the low energy limit, reduces to testing equivalence of inertial, gravitational, and rest mass energies, then for a system that is quantum, those rest mass energy, those different internal, possibly different internal energies are quantum operators. And this means that testing their equivalence is both conceptually and qualitatively different than doing this with classical systems. And another question or line of research that one can approach with this model of ideal quantum clocks is that of quantum causal relations, or let's say phenomenology of quantum spacetimes, because one can consider what would be, as in the case that we looked at, what would be causal relation between events defined by quantum clocks, where they tick in the presence of not a classical state of a source mass of the gravitational field, but of some particular spatial superposition state. And this is enabled by, first of all, having quantized a model for a clock, and additionally realizing that what is relevant for this clock is its relative position, relative configuration of the clocks to the source mass. And recognizing this leads you to the ability to quantize effectively the position of the source mass and construct a scenario where causal relations between clocks are non-classical in the specific sense of pairs of events being entangled while being still time-like. So in particular, one can construct a scenario where you have two pairs of events that are, say, if you call them A and B, you have pair of A's and pair of B's, and you can have a situation where pair of A's is in the past or future light cone of events B in an entangled state. So this is a particularly interesting result, and it comes from Matthias Sonnleitner and collaborators, where they consider the emission of radiation by an atom. And first it looked like there is some spurious friction when this happens. While in fact, what's been going on is simply the fact that when a system emits a photon, not only its center of mass energy can change, but also internal energy. So effectively the mass of the atom can change. So considering this quantized internal energy, or quantized mass energy of an atom, led to the resolution of this apparent paradox. And finally, I'm reaching to the springboard to our results. There have been two interesting works that were looking at double slit experiments with composite particles. So double slit experiment with clocks. And what they found is that as the particles were propagating, the internal energies would delocalize. And this has been taken in the first of the references that you see above as the actual reason for any time dilation induced effect on a quantum particle. And so this is, so I guess you'll see a bit more details about that, because that's what I would like to now address. So essentially, the problem is as follows. We have some initial state of a composite particle, which is given as apparently semi-classical. So we take internal energy, tensor, some Gaussian state of the center of mass, and we let this system evolve. And what we find that the different internal energies would delocalize. Now, if you have a particle in such a state moving towards some screen, the fact that the different internal states delocalize as they move means that they will arrive to the screen at different times. And if there is gravity acting in the plane of the screen, essentially the different internal energies would fall by a different amount when they hit the screen, which would cause lack of fringe contrast. Now, the time dilation decoherence that I probably skipped over a bit too quickly. So that's something you expect to see when you do the first experiment I mentioned with the interference of clocks. There you have that internal state, since they measure proper time along the trajectory of a clock, would reveal a which path information and also lead to some loss of visibility. And so this delocalization was considered to be the same or the underlying effect for time dilation decoherence. Now, if this delocalization was indeed a fundamental and a completely inseparable from the time dilation effect, this would effectively mean that we wouldn't really have clocks in quantum mechanics or these kind of ideal clocks as particles, because as soon as we start to consider time evolution of such a system, the different internal states would just decohere and the clock would be lost. Would just be an incoherent mixture of different energies and different positions in space. And also it would have experimental consequences. As, at some point of precision, you will be forced to consider the longitudinal coherence of your system would be fundamentally limited. Now, if this is not fundamental, then the question is, what are the correct semi-classical states for quantum clocks and how to define them? And let me now show you how one can address this question and what comes out. So if we take a step back, we recall that the Gaussian state is essentially a state that minimizes uncertainty for position in phase space, so position and momentum, and comes from the Heisenberg, from canonical commutator. Now we want to consider a system that has semi-classical propagation, but not in phase space, but rather in space time. So we want to start with the uncertainty and the commutation relation, but in configuration space. So you can define the velocity operator, I mean, just really time derivative of the position operator, and that's simply given by commutator of the position operator with the Hamiltonian. And for the Hamiltonian of a composite quantum particle, you will get the result, which I guess you would expect from relativity. And at lower energies, of course, you recover the non-relativistic relation between momentum and velocity. Now you can look at the uncertainty principle. So this is the Schrödinger-Robertson uncertainty. And there is a general way to find states that minimize it. So you just have to define and suitable operators. And the state that that minimizes the uncertainty is the one that solves this eigenvalue equation that you can see towards the bottom of the slide. I realized I haven't defined omega. It's just a parameter that fixes the units between x and v, so the position and the velocity. So now everything is explicitly defined and you can just solve the problem. And so what one does one get? So first of all, general minimum uncertainty states for position and velocity would be, is a correlated entangled state between the center of mass and the internal mass energies. So the small m's we use for mass energies since it's very telling. And this is a general form of the state for the relativistic Hamiltonian. I don't really want you to focus on the details, just to kind of flesh out, you can fully solve it and it's a straightforward exercise. But I would like to highlight already some key points, some key takeaways already at this stage. So first of all, if one want to consider semi-classical propagation of quantum clocks, one has to consider not a Gaussian state of the center of mass times the internal energy, which would be our go-to choice, but rather a state that minimizes the uncertainty in configuration space, because we want to consider semi-classical space-time trajectories and not phase-space trajectories. And such states are entangled. So you'll see this entanglement is very little. And it's certainly smaller than entanglement between position and internal energy that you get from the delocalization. it's nevertheless there, and I think it's interesting to highlight it. And moreover, these states can be fully characterized both in the relativistic limit and at low energies. So one can define this new class of states and then study their properties. So let's look at low energies because that's also a way. Okay, perfect, fantastic. I'll certainly have enough time for questions. I think it's instructive to look at low energies. That's what we'll do for the rest of the talk. Also because the controversy about the double slit and the localization versus time dilation was indeed obtained with low energy limit of the dynamics. So if you squint your eyes well, you'll see that each of these components is indeed characterized by a mass. And so essentially, if I do the rest of the squinting for you, you will see that this state describes a Gaussian with some initial localization in space given by some of the parameters, and whose peak momentum is mass dependent, and the width is also mass dependent. So the fact that the peak momentum is mass dependent is, I guess, something we should have all guessed from the start. If I want to consider that all my internal mass energies have to propagate as coherently as possible with the center of mass, so have the same velocity, then their momenta will of course be different. If you think really non-relativistically, m times v will give you a momentum, and so for different mass energies, you'll just get different momenta. So that's in there. That's there in the state. The widths are different, and that's just what comes out from the formalism, and that's what gives the minimalization of the uncertainty. Of the trajectory, so the uncertainty of the position and velocity of the entire state. And so just for some cartoon depiction of how this differs from the naive guess with the Gaussian tensor with internal state, so that's what you've seen before. Initially we have a Gaussian state, all the internal energies are localized together, and as the state propagates, the different mass energies will delocalize in space because they move with different velocities. If they have initially the same momentum, and for the minimum uncertainty states in this low energy limit, initially we have all internal energies with slightly different widths. The peaks overlap, and as the state propagates, the peak probability for each mass energy is still at the same point, and of course all these guys spread out as you expect. And so I would like to highlight the main conceptually, I think, interesting or important property of these states, and that they transform covariantly. And so that's best seen if you look at Wigner functions for these states. So this is for the Gaussian. And so essentially, so the top panel shows you the standard Wigner function, position and momentum. And you see that the state that initially was all localized spread out in space. That's what we've seen from the state. And the momentum is, of course, conserved. So it stays the same. Well, if you go to the configuration space version of the Wigner function, you'll see the spread in velocity. So now if you consider starting from a Gaussian wave packet that has in your original frame zero peak momentum, and then you start to move relative to this state, what will you see? Of course, the state will, in the original frame, all the internal energies just spread out. So if you watch this state from a moving frame, you certainly do not expect that the different components will move relative to you with the different velocities. And so that's just an easy way to understand that that this Gaussian state times internal energy cannot possibly transform as we expect a clock would transform. Now, our minimum uncertainty states, they do exactly transform as one expects. So this just completes the diagram for the Wigner function. So our state initially has different momenta, as I already highlighted, while in configuration space, it remains localized. But to see the covariance, one can consider a transformation of these states between different reference frames. And there is a particularly neat way to see specifically that for highly localized wave packets, we get just from the definition of this state exactly the expected time dilation factor, of course, to lowest order in C squared. That's these Gaussian states are minimum certainty states in this low energy limit. So it's indeed expected that we'll recover the redshift factor only to this order of 1/c². So it's not only qualitative, but also quantitatively, these states do indeed represent idealized clocks in that the internal dynamics would be redshifted as you expect from a relativistic clock. How am I with time?
So you have less than 10 minutes left, including question time.
Okay. Okay. So maybe I'll skip the remaining properties of these states. I guess they're interesting, but if you really want to know, then I guess you can see Caroline's paper that explains all this, and the reference is somewhere in the slide. There will also be some discussion of numbers and how big the effects of the localization that our state overcomes could be in some particular context. You can also see the double slit with which I started in the paper and how even though these states do not delocalize, they lead to the expected time dilation decoherence. And so essentially, maybe I'll just mention here, having quantized internal energy leads to two different effects, in fact. So for states like our minimum uncertainty state, one has time dilation affecting internal dynamics of a clock, and this is what will entangle the internal and external states as expected from the generic considerations of which way information the context of quantum and relativistic clocks. And the localization effect that would also be expected from general considerations of a system with a fixed momentum, but some uncertainty in its mass. So these are two different effects that can be separated or considered together. And with this, I'll just flesh out my conclusions and outlooks. I hope I convince you that these minimum uncertainty states are interesting class of states that address some of the questions that arose in the research on quantum matter used for timekeeping. And I think they can find interesting further applications, but maybe I will stop here. And so we have some time for, at least some time for questions. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for this very interesting talk. And we have already some questions. So there was a question from Lee, but I don't see that he doesn't raise hand anymore. So I just want to check that he doesn't want to ask his question.
Hello, okay. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. Actually, I have a comment and not exactly a question. In your first page, you said about the clocks measure the proper time, right? So my comment is actually not all clocks measure the proper time. Yes. So if we have the pendulum clocks, one is on the planet with a stronger gravity, And the other one is on the planet with weaker gravity. And then the pendulum clock on the stronger gravity, on the planet with stronger gravity swing faster. So the time measured become faster. So you can see
the pendulum clock. Differently defined clocks and pendulum clocks also, I mean, of course, our ancestors were using pendulum clocks for a long time. Here I talk about a more modern view of the clock where its system whose timekeeping is independent of the gravitational force. So it's given by some other forces and localized enough not to be sensitive to gravity gradients or artifacts like this, and indeed such system by construction will track proper time. So these are the clocks I'm interested in.
That's what I said. It's just a comment and not a question, so it's not related with your your talk actually.
I guess then
because
maybe
here
we can
is what I just
move
want
to
say because
thank you very much. So maybe we can, since we don't have a lot of time, Marius Christodoulou, can you had a question?
Yes, okay, let me get very quick then. Magdalena, thank you for a very nice talk. I just wanted to ask if you've thought a lot about quantum clocks, if you see any room for seeing another quantum mechanical feature, which is discreteness.
It's actually fantastic that you asked this question. I've just recently with my students, we went through your paper on discreteness of time with clocks. So we really enjoyed the reading and discussing it. So maybe I'll just say one thing. So if it's just a classical discreteness, then perhaps just measuring a phase rather than really timekeeping could be better. But if this discreteness is supposed to be coming from some fundamental measurement of time that goes at the Planck scale, which I understood is one of the posited mechanisms for why time would be discrete and that you suggest in one of the works, then this can be tested. And I would be really relatively confident. I mean, we haven't put in the numbers, but I would be confident that one can find already existing experiment that could put very, very strong bounds on such a possibility. And the reason is that if you consider that there is some fundamental measurement of time going on each time you have a matter wave, and the measurement in the quantum information sense, that there is some information stored locally in the degrees of freedom that go with your particle, with the precision of the Planck scale, then there will always be correlation between position of a system and this internal timekeeping degrees of freedom, which would preclude high contrast in interference experiments. Now, since Planck measurement at the Planck time are so precise, even experiments that didn't witness sufficient gravity to see any relativistic effects would probably be affected by this. Unless for some reason, these degrees of freedom are in a state that is, there is the dynamics that could be timekeeping, but the state is stationary. So you could consider, some state of these Planck degrees of freedom that is very, very delocalized, so that essentially it's time translation invariant. I don't know whether it would be sensible, maybe. I mean, maybe that's actually what is sensible. And that, so one could then consider putting bounds on how well defined could be an initial state of those Planck scale degrees of freedom measuring time, such that it's still compatible with existing experiments. I think that would be the thing that could be said about this particular model for time discreteness at the Planck scale.
Thank you. I will follow up someplace else by email. Thank you very much.
That would be great also for us. Thanks. Thanks for your question.
We have time for one more question, and we have one from Abhi Ashtekar.
So, can you hear me?
Yes,
I can hear you.
Yeah, so I mean, just really continuation of the last question in a way. But I wanted to go right in the beginning because you started very beautifully by saying that, well, here is a general quantum field in a curved space-time, but in kind of without saying it explicitly, you specialize to static space-times and then even to the weak field limit of the static space-time. So
that's right.
Is there any thought at all given to what happens in general curved space-times where there is no Killing vector field? And the reason, so this is the first question, and this the follow-up thing is that for anything like testing the Planck scale effects that you were just mentioning, I mean, these effects are so minute that in my view, they would be swamped by time dependence in the gravitational field, even coming from gravitational waves, for example, but many other effects in the solar system, which would be time dependent. And therefore the description of time independent space-time would just be incorrect. And therefore, it seems to be very hard to really draw conclusions about Planck scale effects or some very high accuracy effects if you don't worry about time-dependent space-times.
Yes, thank you. That's a very precise point indeed. I didn't mention at all, I specialize to static post-Newtonian space-time, really. Everything I said, unfortunately, doesn't say anything about dynamic space-time, but one can apply the formalism also to, at least in some cases, to non-static space-times. And the particular approach that one can take is to consider how such a system couples usually one considers some scalar field. And then use this composite quantum particle as a so-called Unruh-De-Witt detector. And I'm suspecting you're familiar with the
right,
model.
Except that the one particle Hilbert space doesn't make any sense in time-dependent space-time, and therefore the we can
It will be strongly limited. So one relies on the separation of the scales for the various effects, so one can using the detectors in some expanding space-time would so far it's mostly limited to scenarios where these systems are essentially infinitely heavy, so they follow classical trajectories. So effects such as indefiniteness of the number of particles or indefiniteness of the particle perhaps could be separated from the effects that these detectors are used to probe, which is the indefiniteness of the number of particles in the scalar field.
You cannot have such heavy particles, right? Because then they'll create their own gravitational field, they'll collapse to form a black hole.
Of course, if the question is if there is complete theory for such systems in dynamical space-time, that, well, at least I'm not aware. I think some people would be advancing such approach. But what we've been specifically looking at was low energies, plus people that work with similar systems as Unruh-De-Witt detectors explored some of the aspects. I guess there will be other people here on this conference that are more qualified to discuss the Unruh-De-Witt part. With what we discussed with Marius, I guess it was clear that considering that the Planck quantization of time will be the first effect you will see while not being sensitive to other gravitational effects is probably unjustified and would have to be scrutinized from the start.
Right. Thank you. We're on the same wavelength. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot. And I would also like to say that there is also a Slack channel for the conference, and every speaker has its own thread, so you can also ask questions to the speakers on Slack if you're interested, or direct message them. Okay, so let's thank Magdalena again.
Thank you, and do reach out on Slack, or you can find my email easily as well. Thank you.